You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. You know, if you never watched the movie Ray or listened to the soundtrack of that movie, I would encourage you to do so. Interesting life that he lived. Joining me from Tampa is a retired Marine Corps Master Gunnery Sergeant, the principal of the Ubaldi Reports, John Ubaldi. Did you see the movie Ray?
No, I did not see the movie Ray.
All right. Counsel you. Consider yourself counseled, and go ahead and make sure you get that done.
Does that mean I'm going to get a double signed fitness report?
Not necessarily, okay? Because you still have time to take corrective action. However, you know me, you've been around me. However, you know that's a distinct possibility should you not take the appropriate action. Because, again, as I've always said in my life, no attrition, no morale. So somebody's got to pay so everybody else can live. And if that's you, then that's you. You'll make that choice. I will not. It's a great movie. Interesting guy. And the music's in it is awesome. So anyway, tell us how things are in Tampa. Obviously, well, you guys were the subject of much news last week, and life getting anywhere near normal?
Well, they're getting there. Most places have power, at least up in the central part of the state. Down by, I got a friend who lives out by Fort Myers near Naples. She just got her power yesterday. There's still a lot of people. We're still without their homes. I mean, we had a big church crew go down there to assist. I've got another individual who is one of the only two houses that were left standing. He lives in the Keys. He built his house in 2007 to withstand 150 to 160 mile knot wind. So it's still going to take some time. It's still, but the stores, even up here in Tampa, looks like shopping in Russia. They're just obliterated because everybody lost a lot of food, so they had to go replenish their stock, and it's going to take a couple weeks to get the store shelves back to where they were.
Wow. As you kind of went through this, give Florida a grade. How have they done?
I would say for the preparation for the storm, I would give them an A. I think they did it from the local, the county, the state level into the federal government. I'm still a little curious after the fact. I mean, I know there's reconstruction and disaster and all that recovery operation. I'm still kind of curious as why there was so much power outage in areas that were really not affected by the storm. Now, I got it down in Fort Myers, you know, Lehigh Acres or Naples and the Keys, because they really got plummeted. But up here in Tampa, I'm just kind of curious as why was there so much power outages in areas that really were not affected by the storm. So I will give them an incomplete so I can get more information on that one.
Wow. You must be a media person giving them an incomplete and all. I don't disagree with you. I will say this. If that's what we're talking about, then I think the state did pretty good. If that's what we're talking about.
Correct.
All right.
And now, that's something. No, go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's what I'm working with a friend of mine who was really affected by the power, and he's retired, but he's really well connected. We want to find out because TECO Electric or TECO Energy is the main provider in this area. And they were bought out by Emera as a Nova Scotia Canadian firm 2 years ago. So we want to find out is why is there such a large power outage when it was really not affected by the storm? Did they invest in upgrading their power lines to underground cables, to new transformers? you got to put preventative maintenance into your system instead of going to the regulatory bodies and say, oh, we need a rate increase to cover our losses.
Right.
Because that seems to be the standard thing what governments do. They don't invest, but then they want more money, and they say, well, that'll fix it, and then we're back at this situation again.
Well, I will tell you this. One of the conundrums that you face, given the pressure from the public relative to taxes, is this. You run it on you try to run it leaner because you get a lot of pressure and people run as conservatives and things like that. And then if you don't have the reserves to take this on with a publicly regulated utility, there's only one way to get more money. And which is not, so it's, they're not very popular things to do, but I think, you see a lot more things run leaner because there's so much scrutiny over budgets and things like that. And the way to get not elected is go ahead and run on restoring your reserves to twice what you need just in case. See where that gets you.
Well, that's true. I mean, no one wants tax increases. No one wants rate increases. And I understand that you want to have a reserve to cover this because no one wants to do the other thing. But we've seen this across the country where they always seem to say, well, we didn't have the money to fix it. And I mean, I still follow what's going on in California. Look at the Oroville Dam as a great example. They kept blaming, well, it was the water. It was all this rain. When come to find out, it was they didn't invest. They didn't do the proper maintenance on it. It was shoddy maintenance. We saw the same thing with the new span to the Bay Bridge. It was originally supposed to cost $1.6 billion. It ended up costing the taxpayers $6-point-something billion.
Yeah, they did it twice.
Exactly. And California has the largest transportation budget of any really state transportation agency, and you guys got the worst roads out there.
No, we don't.
So I think,
no, trust me, drive on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. You'll pay to drive on that piece of shit. Yeah, and also, go ahead, drive on that thing. You're like, I just paid to drive on this thing, and I'm going to have to get my car realigned by the time I get off it. It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's
one of the... Well, I just remember driving from California to Tampa back in 2013 when I moved out here, and it was a huge difference once I crossed the state boundaries. And as much as people bemoan Texas has some quality roads. Now, we could do a little bit better out here in Florida, but still, they got some pretty good roads. You don't see potholes all over the place. But the point that I'm bringing up is we need to look at how our money is being spent by our government agency. And I was talking with a friend and over the weekend, and she didn't want to hear something I said, something that was dear to her. And I'm like, this is why we've got $20 trillion in debt. I mean, we've got some wasteful government spending that needs to be addressed.
John Ubaldi of the Ubaldi Reports. You can read it there. Just go ahead and search on Ubaldi Reports. And you'll find him waxing eloquent. All right, let me pose a question to you. Bipartisanship doesn't exist, right?
At this point, no, it does not exist right now.
Okay, all right. So how does it work then when bipartisanship doesn't exist? Because the whole system's designed to be bipartisan. You can have a simple majority in the House, right? So you only need, but for the last, it'll be almost 200 years, in the Senate, in order to bring something to the floor for a vote, there had to be something called cloture that was dealt with, and that needed 60 votes. Okay, 60 votes down from two-thirds of the Senate before that. So in order for something to come to a vote, It got pushed to the center because one party couldn't bring it to the floor. Both, you know, you had to have bipartisan support for it. And so my point in saying all this is how our system's built. Okay. The whole system is built to shove to the middle and to force compromise, whether it be through administrative rules of operation of the House and the Senate. Now, the House didn't have those issues because there were so many people, they always had to limit time for debate because, you know, with all the, 425 members of the House, you can't debate in an unlimited way or you certainly would never get anything done. So, how does it work? And so I'll ask you this question. How does it work if it doesn't work in a bipartisan way?
That's the problem. It doesn't work. So what you get is partisanship. But what we've noticed in the last 25, 30 years is we've gotten more partisan as a country and more partisan in Congress, where look what happened when we discussed this last week with DACA, which President Trump dealing with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Well, those on the left said, don't get too cozy with them. We don't want to work with them. And the same degree could be said of Republicans during the Obama administration, that if you work with the other side, you're seen as a rhino or a dino, Democrat name only or Republican name only. And this is, and the American people are like, I don't care who you work with, just get things done so my lives get better. And we're just not seeing that today.
Yeah, but how did we get to a point where there is no compromise? Because the whole system, again, is based on compromise. Everything, the way it's set up. So now what you're telling me is, and I'll give you a premise for this, this got into my head last night. I've been thinking about this stuff for a couple weeks. So the only time legislation can get passed is when you have a majority in the House and you have a supermajority in the Senate that would give you 60 votes. And since no Democrats are going to go with you, you have to have 60 Republicans, and nobody can waver in order for you to bring legislation to the floor. That's the only time that we'll see progress in the nation is when we have something like that.
And
the way things are now, that would be the answer to that would be yes, right? And so somebody was talking to me about, you know, Trump's agenda, you know, based on what he did last week. Trump's agenda is dead. I said it was dead. It was dead on the battlefield. It never even got, you know, it was dead when they loaded on the medevac. It was dead when they got it to the hospital.
But then the other problem comes in because you don't have that supermajority in the Senate. I mean, that veto-proof majority in the Senate and the supermajority in the House. Now you get the parties trying to change the rules to fit their numbers in the Senate, much like what we had with the Supreme Court nominee. Because of what happened prior, we had to go the nuclear option, meaning instead of getting 60 senators, all you need is a simple majority.
I don't know how they did that, though.
Because
reconciliation is designed for budget items, and that's how they brought up the Obamacare. I don't understand how they did the Supreme Court under what way they did that, and so I'm still learning my Senate rules, but I don't understand that. But here's my point, John. My point is this: the country can't work like that. It is, and we wonder how we got this way. When you look at this, so when you look at Donald Trump and you look at the quote unquote wall, okay, that thing was never going to happen.
No.
Never, ever happen. And so, so when people say, well, now he's backed off the wall, look, when you see wall, think Southern security on the southern border. That's what you should think, because there's not going to be a wall. Even the people who want increased security will tell you, oh, we don't need a wall from sea to shining sea. OK, Okay, so it's not going to happen. So in terms of votes and things like that, you can't do it without bipartisan support.
You can't. Nothing got done. All the major legislation in the past had, bipartisan support from both sides. But what we've gotten over the years, we've gotten more ideological in our political candidate. I mean,
okay.
I know.
Okay, so let me ask why. Now, I'm going to ask you, and I have a theory based on a conversation I had with a former senator who told me you can't compromise anymore. If you compromise, all you do is assure yourself of a contested primary within your own party.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's correct.
Okay, so based on that Senator Byron Dorgan, by the way, who chaired the budget committee, I think, for a while. But anyway, so based on that, his contention was the FCC abandoning the fairness doctrine that said that if you use the public airwaves, you had to present both sides of an issue in your programming. So you had Hannity and Combs, not simply Hannity. And so even when you turned on Hannity, you had Combs there fighting with him about these issues. He said when the FCC stopped implementing that, you had the rise of the Rush Limbaughs of the world and this scorched earth. Anybody who steps out of line gets annihilated by these guys on national radio every day for as long as those guys care to do it. And so are you going to get out of line and risk the franchise? Well, let me tell you the political response. No. So I'm going to stay in lockstep with my Republicans, and the Democrats can stay over there, and there is no middle ground. Because it's all principled and those principles reinforced by talk radio. And what, over the course of the years, since probably the late 80s, you have less and less and less bipartisan legislation enacted to the point where we can't pass budgets, we can't do shit today.
But I also think this was an evolved process, and this is what I said in my book, The New Business Brigade. And I know you're going to have after this segment, you're going to be talking with someone who's going to be talking about Ken Burns, the Vietnam War.
Yeah, did you watch that? Did you watch that last night?
I watched it this morning on PBS. But the point I was going to bring up, after World War II, within about 3 or 4 years, half of all students in America at the colleges were veterans. So veterans impacted the American society in every phase, from sports to entertainment to the media. Everybody has served. So the point that I bring up on that is what John Kennedy had said in 1961 at his inauguration. Don't ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Hold on.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
How about that?
And that's perfect. But the statement that I wanted to bring into that was, over the years, we've had less and less people, whether you serve in the military or you serve in another capacity, we have less and less people serving America instead of what can America do for me. Now, you saw what happened in the 2008, early 2009 financial collapse. I guarantee it, that would have never happened decades prior, because individuals would have served their country. Their country meant something to them. This is not like we're taught in the Marine Corps, duty, honor, courage. And I listened to a segment by H.R. McMaster's on Fox News Sunday yesterday, and he was talking about Steve Bannon. And he didn't want to, you know, criticize the guy, but he basically said, I want to put people who put their country first, not their own ideological or their own pursuits. We don't have that. Then you go to the media, where the media had served. They had many guys who had served in the military during the war. Now you have more and more people who go to college, and the military service is an alien culture to them. They don't understand it. We're like a dinosaur with our, with a tag by Mutual of Omaha Wild Kingdom on our ears saying this is what a veteran looks like. It's a far different world than we used to have when I first joined the Marine.
So we need more veterans and...
Well,
I don't know. What I think you need to do is we need to continue to burn it down, and then people, you know, again, I read a piece over the weekend, and the guy talks about, look, you had Donald Trump, who was never the Republican choice, who all he did was he beat all these longtime Republicans, and he was barely a Republican, and then you beat Bernie Sanders. And then you have Bernie Sanders, who wasn't even a Democrat in name till, you know, just before the campaign season, right? Then he declares himself, right? So he was an independent. So he decides he's going to run as a Democrat. And then, truth be told, he beats Hillary Clinton, except for they rig it, and so he can't win.
But the reason I'm getting to is why a Bernie Sanders and a Donald Trump could get to that level. And there's many factors to this, but one of the Bernie things is they tapped into this anger out there in the American public. A lot of the people who voted, they're not Republican or Democrat, or they just want things done. And what people need to realize, the reason why people voted for Donald Trump, especially in those blue states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, who have not voted Republican in 30, 40 years, is they see their lives not improving. I mean, we've got a healthcare law that's out of control. Jobs aren't coming back. I mean, we've got
But that's not what I'm asking. What I want to get back to is, how does a nation function without bipartisanship? Right?
It doesn't function. It really doesn't function without bipartisanship. And at some point, there's going to be, I guess what Thomas Jefferson said, there's going to be a revolution at some point, and something's going to be spilled. I'm not saying it has to be violently, but there's going to be some, people are pissed. They're not seeing their life. Look what's going on now. We've gone 9 months into the Trump presidency, no tax reform, no health care reform. All we've done things is by executive action. That can't last. We don't have a budget. We go through these stopgap measures. We have a debt ceiling. Every couple months, we got to push back the debt ceiling because they can't agree on anything. And at some point, something's got to pop. It just can't go on like this.
Emails. Hold on.
Okay.
Mac, I believe that Trump's agenda was dead before it ever got to Washington, D.C. I'm not sure he knew that, though. I'm not sure how much the Republicans believed that they could hold their slim margin together and deliver on what he wanted to do. Certainly, it would be challenging without 60 votes to get anything done. Myself, I think the day is come and gone for that stupid-ass rule. It needs to go away, because so much legislation can be killed by that. It's ridiculous. And it bottles up the entire legislative process, that number of 60. My question is, do you think Trump knows this? Is he smart enough to see that, and he's just playing the game? Or do you think this has all come as a surprise to him?
No, I think he sees it. I thought, like when we mentioned last week, when it came to health care reform, when the Republican leadership came to him, hey, we can do this, we got this, we've been playing this for seven years, and then they had nothing. So I think maybe that could have been surprising, but I think he knows this. And he's a smart guy, as much as bombastic in his mannerism, but he's a smart guy. He knows how to react and recover from a lot of this. So we'll have to see that this moves forward.
Okay. All right. So you think, I don't know that he knew. I don't know that, you know, the, you know, legislating was kind of a something he's never done. He's always acted, you know, by executive order as a head of a corporation. And so I don't know, you know, it'd be interesting to hear their discussions about that, you know, could they do it? All right. And if they don't, then what road do we travel down? And I said since the campaign, there is not one thing that he said that he will not move away from, right? He doesn't give a rip one bit about the wall, okay? It's important, right? I think to people who voted for him, but but to them, I don't think that he's welded to none of that. You know, I think he'll make a deal on immigration. I think he will make a deal on healthcare. He wants to see it get better. And this is a thing that I think I don't know how we lost this, but in order for it to get better, both sides are going to be unhappy with it, with the eventual outcome. Okay? Democrats are going to have to accept, relative to immigration, Democrats are going to have to accept some form of increased security at the border. Republicans are going to have to accept that we're not going to deport 11 million people.
Correct.
Okay,
but the other part is, in the political parties, we used to have the liberals, the conservatives, and there was a moderate in the meantime. They would flip between both sides. Well, the moderates have been chased out. And what we said earlier, if you go against your party on whatever, you're getting a challenger in the fall. Now, what we're going to see, which was just introduced by Bernie Sanders of Vermont on Wednesday, is in 12 Democratic senators, and four of them are going to possibly run for president. They want to push a single-payer system. And there's that element on the left who you got to support a single-payer system, and you're going to see it in your state of California. Gavin Newsom supports it. And Antonio, if I pronounce his name right, Villagrosa, is kind of ambivalent about it because he wants to see how is it going to be paid.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, if you look at the polls on that, everybody thinks single payer is a great idea. And you have Bernie Sanders up there, right, you know, talking about the system, right? Do you want to come into the VA health system? Is that what you want? Right? Everybody reads about the VA health system, right? And people waiting for months and this list, you know, is that what you want? And then think about that. And then think of when you tell people how much their taxes are going to have to go up to pay for it. Then they say, not only no, but hell no. Okay.
Yeah, but even what people fail to realize on that, it didn't make it in Vermont. They failed. Connecticut tried it. Colorado tried it. California may be getting it for next term. But even the Urban Institute, which is a progressive liberal think tank, they said it would cost $32 trillion to implement a single-payer system. And even Bernie Sanders' own plan would only raise $15 trillion. Where's the other $17 trillion coming from? And nobody talks about the actual cost. That was the same thing in California. The legislative analyst stated it would cost $400 billion to implement. Even if the federal government gave you $200 billion, which is dubious at best, you're still short $200 billion. Your budget's only about $180 billion. Where's this money coming from?
Yeah, so let's just say, so that has to come from your taxes. You've got to pay for it. Okay, and that's why it's great because, you know, Bernie Sanders is talking about including things in national health care that European nations don't include, which is only sends the cost even further north. So again, it's a great discussion. You're going to have the great health care, right? And the government's going to pay for it. No, you're going to pay for it. It's coming out of your ass, and it's not going to be great. It's not going to be great health care. Okay? It's not. And so, anyway, I don't want to talk about healthcare. It's interesting when you talk about, you know, the long lens of how we look at things and how we get to the place that we're at today, which is bipartisanship doesn't exist. And the system only works on a bipartisan fashion because nobody ever has the votes to deal with, you know, cloture. And so if you don't have those, then you can't pass legislation. So how do you get the votes? It's got to be pushed to the middle. It's got to be crafted in committee to have bipartisan support, right? It gets brought to the floor. It gets debated, right? We do our cloture thing, blah, 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 blah. We vote. That's how it works. When you destroy all that middle ground, then you have what we have today. But it's just amazing how we've got there. And the things you hear people say, yeah, we can't work like that. And so I guess when you see that, and then you wonder how we got here today. There you have
it. But then the other part is, just look how we talk to each other. If somebody has a different viewpoint than your own on whether you're Republican, Democrat, whatever viewpoint, they just vilify you. Oh, you're going to kill millions of people, and they make it sound like you're the worst enemy to the country if you have a different opposing viewpoint than somebody. And we're seeing this in the media. We're seeing this at our college campuses. Granted, there's a lot of people didn't vote for Donald Trump, but there's protests out there. Members of Congress didn't even go to the inauguration. The mayor of Tampa, Bob Buckhorn, he refused to go. Like you're undermining the electoral process. This is what they're doing. Whether you agree with them or not, you're still the president. You served under Democrat and Republican presidents. Some presidents I liked, some presidents I didn't, but they still were my president.
All right, let me read you an email. My guest is John Ubaldi of the Ubaldi Reports. We're talking about the system, and a comment over the somebody sent me over the weekend was, you know, Trump's agenda is now dead. Well, it was never alive. You know, it's things that people want, but it's not things that were ever going to be enacted. And so so in that light, you know. Is he going to do this revolutionary thing and compromise with the opposition? Holy shit. Nobody expected that, right? Oh, my God. You know, it's like we become so used to what we hear from Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, and Paul Ryan, this why they're never going to compromise nonsense, that all of a sudden when he crafts a deal and something gets done, we're like, oh, what just happened? Well, that can't be good, can it? Well, maybe it can be. Oh, and they're unhappy, but it got done? Oh, what is that? It sounds like politics to me. Let me read you an email. Come on, Mac. The founders made it hard for a reason to keep the majority from ruling ruthlessly. Our Congress represents a fairly divided country politically. When the voters want change, they will make it happen. Trump is a reflection of that. He is not the first, and there will be more. Our politics have always been nasty. We fought a civil war. Your fairness doctrine, right, is a red herring. Liberal radio has been tried many times and fails every time. That I know. You as a broadcaster should be 100% against the government telling you what to have in a broadcast. You know, I don't know about that. I don't know about that because when I think of great broadcast, what comes to mind is the McNeil Lear NewsHour.
I like that, the PBS.
And they had people from both sides, and it was great. I mean, is there anything more obnoxious than listening to Sean Hannity?
Good God.
I mean, and what is that? And so the problem is, you know, we talk about this echo chamber, you know, and is that the reason? Because the media has so much sway And it's now with no fairness doctrine, you don't have to even, you don't have to address the other side. You have scorched earth in the middle. And so to compromise, you can't do because you'll lose the election. You'll be vilified and you'll be thrown out. And politicians being who they are. In fact, it was interesting in the 9/11 thing that Mike Musselman told me to watch. It's called The Road to 9/11. You could watch it only until October 11th on the History Channel. Write that down and watch it, okay? And then email when you watch it. One of the things that Mike said that, you know, they talk about in the show is that the Clinton administration had 9 separate, there's 2 things that blow you away. They had 9 separate opportunities to kill Osama bin Laden. And they didn't take any one of them. Now, some of them were legit why they didn't. The collateral damage, other people that would be killed, things like that. Okay. And again, and this is now looking at it through a lens of post 9/11, right? As opposed to he hadn't done 9/11 yet. He had said he wanted to you wanted to kill Americans, blah 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 blah. And we knew he was part of the bombing of the Khobar Towers and all the rest of that. But the question is, how much collateral damage would you kill very prominent people from other countries in order to kill Osama bin Laden? So anyway, but when asked, one of the CIA guys is asked, so why do you think they didn't ever took one of the 9 opportunities? And he just looks at the camera and he shrugs and says, they're politicians. They're politicians. Which means they will operate ultimately in their best interest as a politician.
And
if, it's too controversial, they won't go there. And so if it's too costly to compromise, then they won't go there. And what creates the cost? Is it the fact that we have a media that doesn't have to be responsible? All it has to do is earn earnings for its shareholders? And so to me, I think in terms of should I include the minority or the opposing opinion in my programming if I'm going to use the public airwaves. I wrestle with that. And I hear the sentiment that you should resent somebody telling you what to do. But when I look at the outcome, to me there's a responsibility that goes with public discourse. And if you don't feel that, then you become Sean Hannity, right? Or you become some liberal talk show host. Okay? You become one of those things. But if the ultimate outcome is that we affect our government in such a way that there is no middle ground, then to me that's something that you have to look at.
But see, also things, when it comes to like the media, when you were talking about having the opposing viewpoint, what the media, I mean, go back to Tocqueville, he made a comment that the media is out there to sell. And one of the presidents of CNN said the reason we gave Donald Trump so much airtime during the primary is because it was great rating. He would say something, and you know, everybody would scour over there to go find out what he was going to say next. They loved it, but they violated their own ethics, the Society of Professional Journalism. One of the news organizations I like is Reuters because they have a certain code of ethics. You have to present both sides, not just your side. There was one, I think it was Yahoo News, reported something about the riots in St. Louis, and they left out a good chunk of the argument of what started Black Lives Matter in 2014. They conspicuously left that out. And this is what you get. It's like, who can say the most inflammatory things? And they love the ratings on it.
Right. And so, and again, when, cause I will tell you this, and this is to me the danger of it. I'll have people tell me, okay, that, well, you know, Donald Trump's a white supremacist. Like, what? And they believe that because, and if you look at the coverage of the media of somebody like Donald Trump, they just put the numbers out again last week. It's like 92% plus ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC are all, that's all negative to positive, right? 92% of the stories about him are negative. Okay. Fox is the only one that comes close to 50%, you know, on stories about Donald Trump. And so,
well, but even
although, my point is this. We have people now, elected officials, saying that talking to the other side is a non-starter. They can't pass legislation on their own. So where does that leave us in a nation? We have a broken Congress. And I guess
we do have a broken Congress.
So the question is why is Congress broken? And how do you fix it? They stick their fingers in their mouth. They put their fingers up in the air. Should we go to war in Iraq? How's it polling in the district? 90-10, they want to go. Let's go. Do you expect that person to go down and read the classified intel assessment of Iraq and come back and ask hard questions? They don't do that. And so how do we break that? And so to me, the lack of balance in the system to include the media it makes the problem worse.
It does make the problem worse because they feed into it. Even ESPN got into it when a host made a comment that Donald Trump is a white supremacist. I can't remember her name, but I don't watch ESPN to get political insight. I get my insight on sports by watching ESPN.
Jamel something. Now, let me ask you this. Could you imagine if a white male host at ESPN had said something equally inflammatory about Hillary Clinton?
Well, there was. Kurt Schilling made some comments, and he was fired.
And he was fired.
It violated the ESPN's own ethics code.
I know. So Linda Cohen got suspended for something similar. But now you have this, and what matters now in the media is it matters your perspective. Because she said it about Donald Trump, right? And because, right, among a lot of athletes who are minorities, that's okay. There's no repercussion relative to that, okay? Had a white person taken on a black politician, I would tell you there would not have been the same outcome. And so to me, this lack of balance in all of our discourse is the reason why we have a dysfunctional Congress.
No, exactly. But look what happened last night at the Emmy. It was like within the first minute they jumped on that stuff. And even they had a telethon regarding Hurricane Harvey and Irma relief.
Right.
And right in the way, anybody who disagreed with climate change, they just went after them. And we've just gotten away from this political discourse. If you disagree with somebody, you must be the evil empire, Satan reincarnated.
Let me tell you where this goes, right? Ultimately, the networks are going to have less and less power in the world. The power will migrate to Facebook, right? The power will migrate to Google. And they are not conservative organizations. So this lack of balance in discourse, if you're a conservative, if you look over the horizon, there's a tsunami gathering against you.
There is. But the one thing the damage the media is doing, now, Ted Koppel, who used to do Nightline, I'm not sure if he's still doing it.
Doesn't.
He made a comment a little bit about it ago. He goes, all these blogs and all these news orgs, you know, all these people doing their own writing. He didn't like it because he said, we in the media, we've studied this stuff all the time. But the thing that I would tell him, that the reason why these things start up is because people don't trust you. You write what you want to write. You don't do the deep research. And we saw this in the campaign last year when media organizations were colluding with one party and one candidate and got caught. I mean, not saying I agree with
but again, when nobody, here's my point, and then I've got to go. When there's nobody on that program that will look at Koppel and say, that's ridiculous, Ted. Blah, blah, blah. When nobody will look at CNN and said, hey, we just had somebody who very unethically, gave the questions. That was us. Do you think that's right? But there is nobody because it's a Chrome echo chamber, and this lack of balance to me is, where is the McNeil Lear news report? It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't.
So anyway, all right. Say goodbye to everybody.
Hey, if you get a chance, go to UvaldeReport.com or see me on Facebook at Uvalde Reports.
There you go. Very well. Good exit. John Uvalde from Tampa, Florida. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Bob Nielsen. If you're like me last night, you were waiting to watch the Vietnam War, Ken Burns' documentary, and much anticipated. And so as I was watching it and as I was thinking about watching it, I thought, I wonder if Vietnam veterans have a lot of anxiety about this. And I asked Ken Rogers, who made the documentary about Khe Sanh, I asked him to come on, and he will at some point. He said he's traveling right now. And he said, it's already created a lot of discussion among us. So we're going to talk to Bob Nielsen about that. Don't go anywhere.